Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Larkin, Judge Schmidt, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is January 23, 2025. Today, this panel of the court has four cases on its oral argument calendar. I will call the first case. First case is case number A24-533, Oliver Wilfred Cass versus Yiying Sen. I believe counsel are probably familiar with our general rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant will have an opportunity for rebuttal lasting 5 minutes. It's my understanding that appellant's counsel wish to divide the principal argument and the rebuttal argument between the two of you.
That's correct.
Okay, and that is fine with the court. Our lectern is adjustable. There's two buttons on the front edge, which will allow it to go up and down, so you may... Good. All right, then you may begin. Please state your name and the name of your client before you begin your argument.
Thank you. Your Honor, may it please the court, my name is Catherine Graves. I am one of the attorneys for the appellant in this matter, Yiying Sen. Also with me today is Dylan Wallace. Mr. Wallace drafted the brief in our case and will be arguing the rebuttal, if any, for us today. We are asking this court to reverse a decision of the trial court which denied our client's request for an award of, or to consider an award of needs-based attorney's fees. We're asking that that decision be reversed and remanded to the trial court. Your Honor, this case has a long procedural history to it. I'm not going to go through all of it. I'm sure the court has been provided that history by, has already been provided that. Where we're at, Your Honor, is in 2023, this court denied my client's motion to set aside an oral stipulation in the divorce, which had been entered and which had been back, done way back in 2019.
So, Ms. Graves, you are correct that we're familiar with the history of
sure.
the case. At the outset, could I clarify your argument? You did not file a motion for relief under 518.145 sub 2, correct?
Correct.
Did not file a motion to reopen.
That's correct.
And you're not relying on the case of Pooley v. Pooley?
That's, well, not for the purposes of the attorney's fees at this point, Your Honor, correct. That is correct.
And so,
I mean, I think that the logic in that case applies here, but it, you know, technically it's not an asset case, but it's still an issue that was never resolved by at the trial court level in any way.
So, what is your authority for your client's purported right to still seek attorney fees?
Your Honor, Minnesota or 518.14 requires the court to consider my client's request for an award of needs-based attorney's fees. The words used in the statute are shall. It is mandatory.
But don't we assume that means, you know, when issuing a judgment and decree, a district court shall dot, dot, dot? I mean, why is your client entitled to bring a motion for attorney's fees at this stage?
Because the issue was never resolved, Your Honor. It was never addressed. My client raised it in her answer to the petition that was served.
What year was that?
2019, I believe. She would have submitted an answer in either in 2018 or 2019, Your Honor.
So we have an answer in 2018, 2019, stipulation 2019, first appeal decided,
2021,
remand, and then second appeal 2023. And at any point, did you bring to the court's attention the failure to address the attorney fee issue?
We did at the original appeal, Your Honor. The original appeal was about the issue of whether my client's due process rights had been denied. And one of the things we noted was that the oral stipulation never addressed the issue of attorney's fees. And there is case law that talks about the issue of attorney's fees as a totally separate issue apart from any of...
Is that in the appeal in 2021?
No, because it was not, that wasn't the topic at the time.
So when did you raise it? When did you say, sure, this hasn't been decided, we need to have this decided?
In November of 2023, both parties brought post-order motions after the decision came down from the Court of Appeals denying our request to set aside the stipulation. And in that motion, we requested that the court, among other things, address the issue of the division of household goods and furnishings, which had not been a part of the oral stipulation. And we also asked that the issue of attorney's fees be decided. That's when that issue was raised. The other two issues that were raised in that motion have been resolved, but the attorney's fees issue is still outstanding.
Go ahead, Judge Schmidt.
Here's the piece I'm struggling with. The Phillips case talks about Phillips versus LaPlante, that a judgment is not final if need-based attorney's fees is an issue that's still outstanding. That's my understanding of Phillips. Is that your understanding of that case, too?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe that the issue in that case was that the whether or not that it was there was the appeal that had been filed, whether it was timely or not.
Right.
And in that case, the Court of Appeals decided that the issue of attorney's fees was a separate, complete claim and could be brought. I mean, that was a post-divorce motion. But it says here, Your Honor, the issue of attorney's fees is a separate claim based on separate facts that has never been addressed at the trial court level.
And that's the piece where I'm struggling. So it's a separate claim, and in Phillips, the court said that's not a final judgment because attorney's fees is still outstanding. And so at the time of the second appeal, that claim was outstanding. So was that not a final judgment from which you appealed in appeal number two?
It was an incomplete judgment, Your
Honor. Then this court lacked jurisdiction over that appeal. I mean, it's either it was not a final judgment, in which case we did not have jurisdiction over that appeal in the first place.
It was a final, I'm sorry, Your Honor. It was a final judgment as to the issues which were the procedural posture of that case was what we were asking the court to set aside in the terms of the oral stipulation.
Correct, but if the issue of attorney's fees was still outstanding at that time when you appealed, then isn't that claim forfeited? Because you represented that this is a final judgment and we took jurisdiction over the case. And we don't know what claims are out there or what aren't out there, but it came up on appeal as if it were a final judgment. And we took jurisdiction over that, and that would mean any other claim that's not resolved is done. It's forfeited.
You know, Your Honor, I think I'm going to go back and change my answer to one of your last questions. In the Phillips versus LaPlante case, my recollection of the court's holding in that case is that the issue of attorney's fees was a separate issue apart from the entry of the judgment and decree. And that it was not the fact that a judgment and decree had been entered was not a basis to deny the appeal, because the attorney's fees itself was a separate claim and issue which could be brought by the petitioner in that case, and that's what we have here. And again, I know I was asked the question about the Pooley case, but the logic in that case, when you have a central issue in a dissolution proceeding, which has never been addressed either by an oral stipulation, by a decision of the court, it's left hanging out there, and it is still an outstanding claim that can be addressed, separate and apart from the judgment and decree.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Is there no time limit on when it may be addressed? I know that the statute that speaks of need-based attorney fees seems to speak
prospectively. Does the party have enough money to go forward and litigate his or her claim? So we start with the statute that talks about a prospective award of attorney's fees, which seems to indicate the request should be made at the start of the case, which you did. My question then becomes, is there no end date? And I'm looking at a case in the marriage of Pekarik, 380 Northwestern Reporters 2nd, 161, a 1986 case in which this court seemed to say there is a time limit on a request for a determination of a request for attorney fees. We said appellant has had ample opportunity to request attorney fees incurred on remand. Most appropriately, that item should have been negotiated in a prior stipulation. It is now untimely. And we followed that decision again in 1996, saying attorney fees, the request for attorney fees incurred in the post-trial proceedings is untimely. So we do have a couple of cases out there that seem to suggest there is a time limit. And have you passed that time limit by waiting through, you know, two appeals and then a remand to finally say, hey, we want to resolve our attorney fee issue? Is it too late?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe we've waived that right, and I'm not aware.
I'm not suggesting you've waived it. And
sure.
In these cases, the court didn't say you've waived it. They said it's untimely, indicating there is some sort of time bar that comes into play, which is consistent with our policies of disfavoring piecemeal litigation, piecemeal appeals, everything else says you resolve everything at once. Why didn't you make an attempt to resolve this issue sooner than later?
Well, Your Honor, if we had been able to set aside the oral stipulation, we would have been able to raise that issue with the trial court. We were not given that opportunity. We were not, that was not, when we went back to the trial court, it was totally limited. Our discussion was entirely limited to whether or not the original stipulation had been fair and equitable.
So did you ask on remand, did you raise the issue and say, we recognize that this was remanded for consideration of the oral stipulation, we still have an outstanding request for attorney fees we'd like to address. Did you raise that with the district court on remand after the first appeal?
I know the issue of attorney's fees was brought up on remand, Your Honor, because I remember filing an affidavit from my client that included attorney's fees. It was not addressed in the trial court's decision. It was just, you know, and that was one of the arguments that we were making, is that she had incurred substantial attorney's fees. That was never addressed by the trial court.
So, and that was after, okay, first appeal, remand, you raise the attorney fee issues, it goes back up on appeal. In the second appeal, did you say, we have an outstanding request for attorney fees? We attempted to litigate this on remand. We filed an affidavit. We made arguments. The district court ignored our request. Court of Appeals, please do something. District court erred by not deciding attorney fees on remand.
Yeah. I'm not sure that we did it directly that way, Your Honor, but the issue of attorney's fees and the fact that my client had outlined that and raised that in the second time that we were back in front of the trial court, I know that was a part of our appeal.
But my struggle is,
sure,
can you have two appeals, a remand, and at no point insist on a decision or, coming back on appeal, assign error to the failure of the district court to make a decision on the outstanding attorney fee issue?
Well, that is what we tried to do in November last year, Your Honor. I don't know that it would have been appropriate for us to...
I'm saying in the second appeal.
Yeah, and again, we did raise the issue of my client's attorney's fees in the second appeal. It was a big part of it. I mean, the fact that she had incurred thousands of dollars of attorney's fees, and that was a part of our concern, the concern about the fair, whether or not the argument or the agreement itself had been fair and equitable. But again, if you look at the case law, particularly the Phillips case, it does talk about the issue of attorney's fees being a separate claim. It is in every family law case that I've ever done. There's a separate statute. And in this case, the trial court clearly erred when she concluded that there's nothing in the statute that says that this issue has to be addressed. It says that specifically. And there's case law that we've cited that supports that.
Ms. Graves? Your opposing counsel has cited Section 518.145 sub 1 Subdivision 2 is the provision for reopening, but sub 1 says a decree of dissolution of marriage, is final when entered, subject to the right of appeal. I mean, why does not that sentence bar your appeal or your desire or your interest in bringing a motion for fees now so long after the decree?
Again, Your Honor, I would go back to the Phillips case, which talks about the issue of attorney's fees being a separate claim.
If attorney fees was not in the decree, subject to the right of appeal, you could have raised that on appeal. But if it's not in the decree, if it's not resolved in an appeal from the decree, isn't there finality then?
Your Honor, I don't. I would respectfully say no, because again, it gets down to the point that this is an issue which has never been addressed in an oral stipulation. The facts have never been presented to the court. It's no different than the issue of the division of household goods and furnishings, which the trial court did take jurisdiction over.
Well, I mean, Pooley saw a difference, right? I mean, Pooley, the Pooley opinion is expressly limited to division of assets, and when an asset is omitted from the schedule of assets, but this is.
And Your Honor, I guess I would argue that the logic in the Pooley case should apply here, because it is every bit as important of an issue to a client, especially someone like my client, who is the non-working spouse, who is asking for an award of a needs-based attorney's fees. So I really appreciate all of the court's questions today, and we are asking that the court reverse the decision and remand it to the trial court so that this issue can be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graves. Counsel for respondent, you may approach, and at the beginning of your argument, please identify yourself and your client.
May it please the court. My name is Jane Binder, and I represent the respondent, Dr. Oliver Cass. Your Honor, this appeal is nothing more than a attempt by the appellant to try to get more money from the respondent than the generous property settlement she negotiated on July 24, 2019, over 5 years ago. As the court knows, she tried to set aside the agreement. This court affirmed the trial court's order, and that was also the judgment and decree. And I agree with the questions being asked this morning that if there was a request for attorney's fees that they felt was not addressed in the judgment and decree that was affirmed by this court, they should have raised the attorney fee issue at that time. Ms. Graves says, well, we talked about the attorney's fees. They talked about that it wasn't, that was why it wasn't fair and equitable. And that was the basis of her motion to set aside. But there was never a motion for attorney's fees brought to the trial court or appealed to this court. And the time for doing that was then. And it's not timely to do that now, as you say. Judge Larkin has pointed out cases that preclude the motion and that appellant brought in the district court. And keep in mind that appellant was represented by many counsel, and at the time of trial, she was represented by highly regarded counsel. And when we had a call, counsel had a call with the trial court, the trial court asked, what are the issues for trial? And at that point, there was no mention of attorney's fees by her counsel, and an order was issued saying these are the issues for trial, and they never asked the court to correct it. I went through all the trial exhibits that appellant provided. There were no attorney fee exhibits.
Well, to be fair to your opponent, you or your husband's or your client's attorney drafted a judgment of decree that included attorney's fees, and they objected to it, saying there's no attorney's fees, and the final judgment of the decree did not include that provision.
You're correct, but the final decree and the earlier decree that was modified did say that each party was responsible for their own debts and obligations dating back to the day that respondent filed for divorce. And if that doesn't include attorney's fees, I don't know why not. I think when the first decree was drafted, it was just to, you know, to cover all corners and mention the attorney's fees, but I think it's covered under the debts and obligations clause that's in the current decree.
Don't
and
we
was
normally
in that
treat
decree.
Debts separately than attorney fees? I mean, an attorney fee award, especially need-based, conduct-based, seems to be its own beast rather than just lumped in with the debt column.
Well, it is called debts and obligations. And I would also argue that when people settle, and this is the case law, such as Claybaugh and Kaiser and, there's a lot of cases. When people settle, they negotiate and make lots of considerations. This appellant received an incredible property settlement. She got more than half of the marital property. Dr. Cass had a lot of non-marital assets, but she got more than half of the marital property, and that any attorney's fee claim was wrapped into that settlement.
What was her property award dollar amount ballpark?
Well over $1 million in 9-year marriage.
She was obligated to pay off a $600,000 mortgage.
Right, but
so
she
it's
got
more like $500,000.
Well, she got the house that was her, that's all, I mean, that's not all she wanted, but that was her primary motivation, her desire.
But I mean, before you argue she got a huge property settlement, we have to consider the obligations that came with it. One was you have to pay off the mortgage.
Mm-hmm. But even with that consideration, I believe she received far more than 50% of the marital assets that the parties had accumulated. And she agreed to it. She said on the record, I agree to this settlement. She said on the record when her attorney asked her, you know you can't come back and change anything. She said, I understand that. I'm paraphrasing. I'm not quoting.
That was before the first appeal, correct?
That was on the record at the time the settlement was reached in
right,
2019.
Right, but then this court said, no, we're not satisfied that she voluntarily agreed to all this. We're remanding for a hearing, so it's difficult for me to take a look at things she said on the record before the first appeal when we reversed, accepting her argument, said it might not be a valid settlement. And I recall looking at parts of the transcript when she said, well, wait a minute, if I have to pay off this mortgage, I'm not going to have enough money to live. So I do think she may have said I agree to it, but she was also raising red flags about whether or not she would be able to live on this amount of money if there was the requirement to pay off the mortgage.
That's fair, but then in her motion to set aside the agreement, the district court judge found that her arguments were not credible, she was not credible, and that it was a fair and equitable division of assets. And you, this court, not you necessarily, affirmed that. So I think in the law of the case, she has already tried to argue that she didn't get what she should have gotten, and she has not
prevailed. And I feel like we're getting off track, and we should focus on the procedural issue, which was the motion to decide the attorney fee issue properly bought? Was there authority for it? Was it untimely? I think that's where we need to focus.
Sure. I did argue in the respondent's brief that this appeal should be dismissed because the theory on which appellant is bringing her motion or her appeal is different from that which she brought in the district court. And I'll just briefly say, in the district court, everything appellant argued in her written submissions and her oral argument was pooley, pooley, pooley. And in this case, she's arguing that Minnesota Statute Section 518.14 mandates that the trial court hold a hearing, and that was not the argument she made below. I was set to respond to a Pooley brief, and there was Pooley wasn't even mentioned in the original brief. But assuming the court does not dismiss on that ground under Thiel v. Stitch, 518-145, as Judge Johnson pointed out, is the governing law on this case. When a decree is entered, it is final, unless you appeal, which she did, and her appeal options, she went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Her appeal options are exhausted. And then you have some options under 518-145 sub 2, but she didn't bring her motion under that statute. She's arguing that because there's an attorney fee statute that says, I think, while a case is pending, the court shall consider an attorney fee request, she's arguing that that has no time limit.
Ms. Binder, you're asking us to affirm.
Yes. Actually,
should we affirm for the reasons stated by the district court, or should we affirm with some alternative reasoning?
I think the district court was mostly focusing on Pooley, because that was what was argued. I think 518, the affirmance should be based on 518-145 and the fact that that a decree is final and there's no authority, including the Phillips case, which counsel kept citing, to say that this attorney fee issue can be brought at any time. I liken this to, what if in a petition someone says, I have a non-marital claim to my home, and then that parties reach an agreement and it doesn't mention the non-marital claim to the home. Can the party come back 5 years later and say, wait a minute, my non-marital claim to the home was never addressed by the court? People reach agreements for all sorts of reasons and put things in their petitions and counterpetitions for all sorts of reasons. The fact that it was there, but she did not argue it at the trial, before the trial, or post-trial until November of 2023, says it's not a timely nor is there any statutory or case law that gives appellant authority for bringing this motion at this time.
Counsel, what effect do we give, if any, to the fact that the settlement agreement that became the judgment and decree does not contain a release of claims?
I think that does not apply. I mean, I don't think that keeps the door for attorney's fees open, because attorney's fees, if you read 518.14, and I'm sure you have, it specifically says in a case, in a divorce, or in a, I can't remember the exact language, but in a specific matter, a family court matter, you can ask for attorney's fees. And had she pursued it, had she told the court it was an issue for trial, had she said, put in attorney's fees exhibits, I think the court, I think she'd have an argument. But I see the release as something where you're releasing claims of tort against your spouse, you're releasing other claims that you might have.
But if attorney's fees are a separate claim, and we construe the party's agreement per the plain language of the agreement, there's nothing that releases that separate claim. It's just a settlement of the specific items that are listed in the settlement agreement.
Well, that gets back to my argument about the non-marital claim that might not be listed. I don't necessarily agree it's a separate claim. I think in the Phillips case, that was all about whether or not the case was ripe for appeal. It doesn't stand for the proposition that the attorney's fee claim can be brought at any time. So I don't see that as, I mean, she didn't sign a release, but she also didn't reserve that issue, which if she really was concerned about it, she would and could have done. This seems like an after the fact, I didn't get a lot of money. I didn't get anywhere with my maintenance claim post-settlement. I didn't get anywhere with my personal property claim, let's try for attorney's fees. It just seems like she's grasping at straws to try to get more and more from her former husband, who simply wants this litigation to end.
Does the record indicate whether either at the time of the settlement or the most recent motion, does it indicate whether she had outstanding invoices with her attorney or, on the other hand, whether she had paid off all those bills?
At some point in this, you know, many long years process, there were attorney fee. There was a submission of what she, I believe, had paid. I think it was credit card statements, but I honestly can't tell you. I know it wasn't at the trial that settled. I know, but at some point after that point, and it may have just been, I may have not seen that until the motion brought in November of 2023. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I can't recall every aspect of this case. But I think it was with the November 2023 motion. If appellant's theory stands and you reverse and remand or remand this case back to the district court, I think that's a violation of the many cases that say that this court and appellate courts should only reluctantly modify parties' agreements. And as I started to say earlier, when parties reach agreements, they make compromises. And they make all sorts of, they have personal reasons for reaching the agreement that they reach. And to review one aspect of an agreement that allegedly wasn't considered, we don't know if it was considered. I mean, I know, but it is to second guess what the parties were thinking. And at this point, we're talking about five and a half, close to 6 years ago. If she's permitted.
So, Ms. Binder, your time has expired.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You may sum up if you wish.
Sure. I think I'll just sum up by quoting the Shirk case, the Minnesota Supreme Court. If we were to allow a settlement made in open court to be reopened many months later at the whim of either party, it would create uncertainty, chaos, and confusion as to the effect of settlements in future cases. In the interest of justice in this case and the sanctity of settlements in the future, we ask that the court affirm the lower court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Binder. Counsel for appellant, you have an opportunity for rebuttal. Please again state your name and your client's name.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Dylan Wallace. I represent the appellant, Ying Sen. I want to start with Judge Larkin's point about the Picard case and the in remarriage. I believe it was Cecilia V. O'Neill. The court should not rely on those cases to determine that the request was untimely, specifically because the Picard case, decided in 1986, predated the amendment of Section 518.14. Prior to the 1990 amendment, the statute, and I'll read directly what the statute used to say. It used to say, in a proceeding brought either for dissolution or legal separation under this chapter, the court from time to time, after considering the financial resources of both parties, may require one party to pay a reasonable amount necessary to enable the other spouse. So a discretionary provision, not the revised language with the shall language that, as the current statute exists, which does not give the district court discretion to not consider a.
What about the rest of the language in the statute, which indicates it's a prospective award?
Are you referring to the previous version or the current version?
The current version that uses the word shall. What is the language in the current version? Shall order fees which will enable the person to carry on the litigation, something to that effect?
Correct, Your Honor. And I would refer then, if I understand your question, is it referring to the timeliness of making the motion
what
in November?
It's like to the extent you're saying shall, that doesn't answer in my mind the question of whether there is sort of a time requirement on when you can make the request. You make the request, the court shall
granted if it's proven, but is there a timing requirement? And as to timing, my recollection of that statute is it speaks in terms of ordering attorney fees at the front end of the case so the person can litigate the case, as opposed to coming back in 5 years later saying, well, now give me my attorney fees.
I understand the concern. I would direct the court to the February 2019 petition, counter petition, and objection filed by the appellant in this case, which did request the need-based fees at that time.
But then did not insist that the court rule on that request at any point until 5 years later.
I would disagree with that assertion and characterization of the record. In the send to the second appeal, that was raised as an issue of why the stipulation should be undone.
But it was raised as an issue as to why the stipulation was undone. Was it raised in this sense? We requested attorney fees in 2019. The district court has ignored our request. We need a ruling on that request.
My recollection of the record is that you're not going to find a request like that in between the 2019 counter petition and, for example, the second appeal. However, I'm not aware of any authority that would require that request to be reasserted in order for it to be timely. And again, I don't believe the court should rely on the Picard case or the non-presidential case that cited Picard because of the change in the statute. The Picard case is correctly decided because it was a discretionary decision from time to time. But the language that the legislator amended does not give the district court discretion to just not consider a request. And there's no other statutory language or other case law that requires a party to maintain that request to make a subsequent request.
So your position is that your request was in the pleading?
It was the answer? Correct. Yeah, the February 2019 objection and counter petition includes the need-based request.
Doesn't 518.145 sort of require you to raise the issue and get it decided? I mean, we've talked about release of claim. The question I have is, how does a release of claims reconcile with 518.145, which says a J&D is final? There are only limited circumstances in which you can reopen. 3 out of 5, you must make the motion within 1 year of the J&D, which didn't happen here. So how do you say both that, well, as long as we've pleaded something, we can raise it at any time if it hasn't been addressed by the district court, and a statute that says J&D is final, you can only reopen under these circumstances?
I think
what circumstance under that statute allows you to reopen the J&D to include attorney fees?
I think my response is somewhat threefold and requires looking at three different aspects of this case. First, our position is that we're not requesting to reopen the J&D because the J&D does not contain a ruling or a decision on the relief we're requesting. So we're outside the J&D is the first point. Secondly, I guess that raises the subsequent question, well, is it required to be included in the J&D? And should we have requested that to be included? And the answer is no. I think the Phillips case is where that kind of links in, and the logic of Phillips can be applied similarly here in that it's not required. I see my time expired. May I complete my answer?
You can complete your answer to Judge Larkin's question, yeah.
Yep. So first, we're outside of the provisions of the statute because we're not challenging the finality of the J&D because it was not included. So it's not a term of the J&D, so we can't challenge that. Phillips allows both these issues to be considered separately, and then again, we return to the plain language of 518.14, which requires the district court to issue a decision. And again, absent any authority or any case law saying that there's a time limit that must pass before that to be decided, I don't see the authority for the court to say that we've waived that claim, except for the point Judge Johnson made about the prior appeal and whether that resolved that. And I believe I've already addressed, and specifically page 23 of appellant's brief in send to addresses the attorney's fee claim as a reason to undo the stipulation. That should be enough to preserve the issue that we're hearing today. If there's no other questions.
One more question.
Go ahead, Judge Schmidt.
So I want to bring you to Phillips again and have you take a shot at this, because I'm still stuck on this language. The order filed on April 19th, 2012 was not final and thus not appealable because the order did not fully determine appellant's separate claim for need-based attorney's fees under 518.14 subdivision 1. So to me, that's saying that the judgment and decree cannot be appealed unless the attorney's fees were decided. So then are we in a situation where your argument is saying appeal number two was an appeal from a non-final judgment in which this court should not have took jurisdiction over? I mean, that's the inherent logic of your argument coming back to Phillips.
So I think, again, a twofold response, and I think it's a good question. I think the logic of Phillips is sound in the way I'm applying it. In terms of the implication that there might not have been jurisdiction in the prior appeal, that may be correct, that there was not jurisdiction.
But you represented that it was a final judgment. And so if you took an appeal representing it was a final judgment and asking us to make a decision, then at that point, any other claim that was outstanding would be forfeited.
And I think my response would be that because the issue had not been resolved, that the attorney's fee issue had not become an appealable decision, even if the underlying judgment was appealable.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.